have now kind of banned us from those clubs. Because at one point we had a problem with the police, who thought that the Hands of Venezuela meeting was somehow something subversive that shouldn't be allowed, and we were kicked out from one pub. So we're now here. Not the best venue, as I say, but it's an important subject. Venezuela and Iraq have actually many things in common. They are both oil-producing countries, and this is, in both cases, one of the main reasons why the United States imperialism wants to intervene in these countries and take control over these oil resources. It was only Thursday this week when the United States published what is called the National Security Report. Is supposed to be guidelines for the policy, foreign policy of the United States for the next period. When I was reading this report, for the first time it mentions countries like Venezuela, Colombia, Bolivia, and I thought I had to write it down, because otherwise people wouldn't believe what it says in this report about Venezuela. And it says, in Venezuela, a demagogue awash with oil money is undermining democracy and seeking to destabilize the region. And then it says about Colombia, it says, in Colombia, a democratic ally is fighting the persistent assaults of Marxist terrorists and drug traffickers. So you can find many statements, but you will find very few statements that are farther away from the truth from this than these ones. In Venezuela, for the last 8 years, there has been a revolutionary process, which you could say started or had one of its main initial turning points in 1998 in December, with the election of Hugo Chavez as a president. But the roots of this movement go a bit further back, to February 1989, when the newly elected government of Carlos Andrés Pérez, who had come to power on a number of promises of social welfare policies and so on, implemented the IMF package of policies just 1 week into his presidency. And this sparked a mass popular uprising, which was known as El Caracazo. But in fact, it was not only in Caracas, it was throughout the country. 27th of February, 89, the people rose up against the increase of the prices of fuel, increase of the prices of public transport, the end of subsidies to basic food products, and so on. And the government replied by declaring the state of emergency for 1 week, suspending all constitutional and democratic guarantees, and by massacring the population, by using the army against the unarmed demonstrators. For a week, there were shootings and clashes all over the country in the main cities. And up until this day, it is yet not known how many people died as a consequence of that repression on those days. There are some estimations that say 1,000 to 2,000 people died. This was a major massacre against an unarmed people whose only crime was to rise up and defend their rights, conditions, living standards, and so on. They were being threatened and attacked by this government, the Carlos Andrés Pérez government. This was the beginning of this movement, a movement that was continued in 1992 with a military uprising. A number of officers in the army who did not agree with the idea that the army should be used against the people. They didn't agree with that, nationalist, progressive officers, and they tried to organize a coup. For a number of circumstances, they didn't get any popular support, the coup failed, but these army officers were led by Hugo Chavez, who was then an unknown figure, who became very popular as a result of this military uprising against an unpopular government. And later on was elected president in 1998 against all odds, because he was standing against another candidate which was supported by all traditional political parties that had ruled the country for 40 years in an alliance, the so-called Social Democratic Acción Democrática and the Social Christian or Christian Democrat COPEI. They had ruled the country for 40 years. Actually, had signed an agreement called the Punto Fijo Agreement, which divided political power, the judiciary, the trade unions, everything was divided between these two main parties, and there was no option apart from these two parties. They all stood against, with a common candidate against Chávez. Nevertheless, Chávez, which had the support of no traditional parties, who was an outsider, won a landslide victory in December 1998 in the presidential elections. And this was the beginning of something much more important. It was not just an electoral victory, it was the beginning of a revolutionary process, the beginning of a revolution, which became known as the Bolivarian Revolution. And at the beginning, this is interesting, because at the beginning Chávez had a program which was a program relatively progressive, but not very radical, program of reforms, in which he said he wanted to clean the state apparatus from corruption, he wanted to distribute land to the poor peasants. In Venezuela, 80% of the land is owned by 1% of the land owners, which keep this land mostly idle. And he wanted to introduce a number of reforms, reaffirm the nationalized character of the oil industry, but not nationalize anything. In fact, oil industry had already been nationalized in 1975-76 by the first Carlos Andrés Pérez government. And he just wanted to introduce a number of reforms so that the enormous wealth of the country will, to a certain extent, benefit the people, ordinary working people, the peasants, and so on, in the country. And he went on television many times by saying, look, this is not a poor country. The reason why about 60% of the population of Venezuela live under the poverty line is not because we are a poor country. And he did a campaign which was basically a mass campaign of political education. And it was on weekly broadcast on television with a map of Venezuela, and he said, look, this country is rich. We have oil here, here, here. We have gold here, here, here. We have diamonds. We have all this natural wealth. Nevertheless, 60% of the people are poor. And the main reason is because the wealth is in the hands of a wealthy minority, which is called the oligarchy, an alliance between the owners of the banks, the owners of industry, the owners of the land, and the U.S. imperialism, the oligarchy. This was very dangerous, because you can win an election saying you're going to fight against corruption, but when you start rising the consciousness of the people to the real reason for their problems, this becomes very dangerous, for this oligarchy. And then very soon they started to organize a campaign against Chávez. In the first months, maybe in the first 1 year of the Chávez government, they tried to compromise with him. They tried to buy him off. They pushed him. They told him that you should be moderate. You cannot solve all the problems of the country just in a few years. And they tried to push him in that direction. But in December 2001, Chávez passed 49 enabling laws, which the oligarchy understood clearly that they couldn't compromise with this president. That this president was serious about applying these reforms, which are basic reforms. Again, as I say, it was not a particularly radical program on the face of it. It was definitely not a socialist program that didn't include the nationalization of private property or the nationalization of anything. But nevertheless, this program, land reform, and maintenance of the nationalized character of the oil industry, was already too much for this wealthy oligarchy that had ruled the country for 40 years through democracy, and for 100 years, or maybe 200 years since the country's independence, if you want to take it as a broader period. And so, from December 2001, they started organizing a military coup against Chávez. Now, as we know the story, this coup failed and it was defeated in less than 48 hours. And now there are people in Venezuela and abroad that say the reason why the coup failed was because it was badly organized. The coup plotters started infighting amongst each other. But this is not the real reason. This coup was meticulously prepared. And the people who organized this coup, the U.S. Embassy, the U.S. State Department, they have quite a lot of experience in organizing similar coups. been successful on a number of occasions, and they use the same, exactly the same blueprint. You remember that in, or you read about the coup in Chile. They started with a campaign in the media. Then they had they mobilized the middle classes against the government. Then they called a so-called strike of the truck owners to paralyze the economy. Exactly the same measures were taken in Venezuela. They organized a campaign of the media. It's fully owned by two or three monopoly groups that are linked to the opposition, are linked to the centers of wealth and power in Venezuela. They organized a campaign of slanders and lies against Chavez and his government, saying this was an undemocratic government. And then they organized also a phony strike. They called for a national strike in order to paralyze the economy, sabotage the economy, and prepare the conditions for a military coup to take place. So this was a very well-prepared coup. And as I say, the people who organized it have quite a lot of experience in organizing coups. Now, so far, the sun sits over here now. The Venezuelan Revolution up until April the 11th, 2002, is not surprising. We've had many left-wing governments elected in Latin America and in other parts of the world, but mainly in Latin America. These governments, in many cases, have opened a revolutionary process, the mass participation of the people. And in many cases, they have been overthrown by military coups organized with the participation of the United States. So far, there's no difference. What made a big difference in Venezuela is the following, that in less than 48 hours, people came out on the streets and overthrew this military coup. And the very interesting thing is that they didn't even know there had been a coup. The mass media, they were all reporting that Chavez had resigned, because he was responsible for the army shooting on unarmed demonstrators, and as a result, he had resigned. There was no other version. This was the official version that was put out by all the private media and by the state media, which was taken over by the coup plotters. Nevertheless, despite this, after 24 hours, people started coming out on the streets demanding that the president they had elected be brought back into office and defeat the coup. Hundreds of thousands of people came out on the streets. There are some calculations that on those days, about 10 million people took to the streets to protest in a country of only 25 million inhabitants. It is the whole of the population out on the streets against this military coup. And this is what a revolution is. Revolution is the active participation, not of a small minority, but the mass. Sorry?
It's democracy.
That's a revolution is also democracy. So what Bush is saying about Chavez undermining democracy is really laughable. 10 million people came out on the streets, unarmed. They gathered around the military barracks, for instance, in Maracay, in the 42nd Parachute Division, played a big role in the overthrow of the coup. They gathered around tens of thousands of people, shouting, "We want our president back, the people united will never be defeated." And this had an impact on the army soldiers, but also on a layer of army officers who were close to Chavez, who had participated with Chavez in the coup in 92. And these people came out against the coup. And you can see it in some of the documentaries. There's images of these military officers standing on top of a tank, addressing the people, and the people demanding that the president be brought back. And then finally, they overthrew the coup in less than 48 hours. In about 46 hours, the president, Hugo Chavez, was back into office. This is what is unprecedented anywhere in Latin America. And although I am not an expert in history, but I will ask yourselves whether you know of any case of a military coup that has been implemented, a victorious military coup that is then overthrown in such a short period of time anywhere in history. There must be very few examples of a thing like that. And this is a very important thing, because in the whole of Latin America, for many years, there was a whole generation that had lived through the coups of the 1970s. And they had this idea in their minds. Well, we can elect the president, we can have a number of progressive reforms, but it will always end up this way. The United States will intervene, the military will organize a coup, and there's no chance, we have no hope, there's no point in even fighting because we are defeated from the beginning. And Venezuela showed that it's precisely the other way around, that the strength of the mass mobilization can defeat this. Now, immediately after the coup, some of the people who participated in the coup were people who had been very close to Chavez, including a guy called Michelena, who was his main political mentor, a guy who used to be a member of the Communist Party in the 1960s, and he participated in the coup as well. So Chavez was shocked about the coup, and he came out on television immediately as it was reinstalled into power, and he made an appeal for national reconciliation. He appealed to everybody, including the opposition, to talk, and to stay within the limits of democracy, and this was a big mistake, in my opinion, because the opposition, the oligarchy, the capitalists, the owners of industry, the owners of the banks, the owners of the landowners, couldn't compromise with Chavez, as long as Chavez didn't betray the mass movement that put him in power, because there were a number of basic things, land reform, nationalized character of the oil industry, and a few other things, that he couldn't negotiate away. If he had negotiated those things away, then he would have lost the mass popular support that he had. But he made this appeal to the opposition to negotiate. The opposition didn't want to negotiate anything. There was not an end to the revolutionary process, the demobilization of the people, the withdrawal of all the laws that had been introduced, and the resignation of Chavez. So in these conditions, very difficult to negotiate. But it's not because Chavez didn't want to negotiate, because the oligarchy couldn't negotiate on those conditions. Their conditions were very clear. And what happened after that was that the oligarchy used that breathing space. No measures were taken against the coup organizers. In fact, in August 2002, the Supreme Court of Justice, full of the people from the old regime, declared that there had been no coup in Venezuela, ruled that there had been no coup, there had been a vacuum of power, and Pedro Carmona, who was the president for 48 hours, just happened to pass by, and he filled the vacuum of power. Now, you might think that this is hilarious, and it is in a sense, but this is actually what Carmona said in his statement to the court that was investigating the events of the 11th and 13th of December. So you can accuse Chavez of many things, but you cannot accuse him of being harsh on the opposition or being a dictator. In fact, many people in Venezuela in the revolutionary movement were asking themselves, when are these people going to be put in jail? When are serious measures going to be taken against these people? So criticism of Chavez was coming, not because he was a dictator, authoritarian dictator, but because he was being too lenient on the opposition. Then in December, the opposition went for another attempt at overthrowing Chavez. They organized a so-called strike. They called for a national strike, but this strike was no such strike. I mean, if there are any people here from the trade union movement, and I can see there's a few, a strike is when the workers decide to withdraw their labor for their demands, be these demands political, economical, or the collective bargaining demands, or whatever. In Venezuela, what happened was that the bosses, the employers, decided to shut down the factories. This is not strike, this is a lockout. This is the bosses' strike. And this is what happened in Venezuela, and I saw it with my own eyes. There were mass meetings outside, for instance, the Firestone plant in Valencia, the Nissan plant in Valencia. The workers demanded to be allowed back into the factories, and they threatened the employers that if they were not let in, they would occupy the factories against the wish of the employers. And the one place where this so-called strike had an impact was in the oil industry, because the oil industry for a long time had created a very privileged layer of people, quite a lot of people, maybe 8,000, 6,000 people who were there that had managerial positions, directors, engineers, and so on, and they were committed to this opposition. they knew that if the company was privatized, they would reap the benefits, and they were completely against the revolutionary movement. They were prepared to sabotage the oil company, and the oil company was sabotaged. Now, in a country like Venezuela, this would spell the death for any government. They cannot get the revenue from oil, from the oil industry. Oil production went down from 2 million barrels a day to 200,000 barrels a day in the first days of the sabotage of the oil industry. But what happened in the days after that was also similarly amazing as what happened on the 12th and 13th of April 2002. And this is that the workers took over the installations, the communities came out and defended the workers, section of the military and the National Guard supported the workers and the communities, and they took over the PDVSA, the oil nationalized oil company, and they ran it under workers' control with no managers and no directors for about 60 days. The lockout lasted for 63 days, and about after 20 days or so, production had recovered, and the workers were able not only to restart production, but also to overcome sabotage, because the managers had run away with most of the software keys, most of the computerized systems had been destroyed that run this very complicated, very complex, technologically advanced industry. This is very important, because for the workers, it was a struggle against imperialism, was a struggle against the oligarchy, but at the same time, it made them aware of the power they have. They could, for the first time, they realized that the workers are very powerful, but they can run such an industry as the oil industry in Venezuela on their own, without any need for directors, managers, and unelected officials and foremen of any kind. They run it under their own control, and they saved the industry for the whole of the Venezuelan people. This was their conclusions out of this. But this was also dangerous, very dangerous for the oligarchy, because the workers drew the conclusion, if we can run PDVSA, the most advanced, technologically advanced industry in Venezuela, and probably in the whole of Latin America, and the workers' control, we can also run any part of society, any part of the Venezuelan economy. And this led to a movement for workers' control, in which the workers occupied factories where they had been locked out, demanded expropriation, and so on. After this second attempted coup, the reaction of Chavez was different. Remember that in April 2002, he appealed for reconciliation, for negotiation with the opposition. This second time he said, well, they've had two chances, now we are going on the offensive. And he started implementing a number of very progressive measures that have been implemented over the last 2 years, particularly when the government got finally control over the oil industry and the resources that come from that. And this is an amazing program that has been implemented in just 2 years. And this program has eradicated illiteracy in Venezuela. Venezuela is only the second country in the whole of the American continent, including the United States and Canada, where illiteracy has been eradicated. The first one was Cuba after the revolution in 1959. The second one was Venezuela, with the help also of some of the methods that were used in the Cuban campaign against illiteracy. I think it's 1.8 million people were lifted out of illiteracy in the space of 18 months. Massive campaign. You see interviews in the Venezuelan media with these people, and you can see that this, for them this is really, really very important. It doesn't put a plate of food in their table, but it puts something very important in their minds and in their heart. It makes them believe in this revolution that has given them access to read and write for the first time in their lives. And this is very important. He also distributed about 3 million acres of land to peasant cooperatives, and a whole number of very important reforms, including the health program, which is called Barrio Adentro, into the neighborhood, that brought primary health care to the people in the poor communities in Caracas and outside, in the barrios, in the neighborhoods, with the help of about 20,000 Cuban doctors and medical personnel, nurses, and so on. People who had never had access to health care before, and now they have a community doctor who lives in the community, who knows the people, and who's available to help the people at 24 hours a day. This is obviously been very important development. Now, I've been talking quite a lot about the background. and I don't have much time, and I think it's important people make questions, but I would like to say one thing. In the last 1 year, the Venezuelan revolution has speeded up quite a lot and has opened up a number of very important debates. One of these is about workers' control. About 1 year ago, January 15th, 2005, Chavez expropriated a paper mill that had been locked out by its owners, Benepal, in the state of Carabobo. And he said that this was being given to the workers and the workers' management. This was not an attempt to create state capitalism. It was an attempt to give the workers power to manage the economy. And this became an example for other groups of workers in other parts of the country. And then in March, about 1 year ago today, he appointed Carlos Lang as the president of Alcasa. Alcasa is a state-owned aluminium factory, aluminium smelter in the state of Bolivar with about 1,600 workers. He appointed this Carlos Lang, who had been a former guerrilla, considers himself to be a Marxist, with the idea of introducing workers' control in this factory. And now they have a system in Alcasa where the workers elect all the managerial layers of the factory. These people are elected with the right of recall by the workers who elected them, and they don't get any wages on top of what they used to get before being elected to these positions. And this is also now spreading to other factories because workers are thinking, well, this is a good idea, we can also implement it. I would also like to say that this problem, this process, workers' control, workers' management, all this discussion of what in Venezuela they call cogestión, poor management, but in reality it's workers' control and management, is not without problems, not without contradictions, and not without difficulties. But the important thing is that the process has begun. This is a major discussion in the workers' movement, in the labor movement in Venezuela, which is a very important one. And the second important thing that Chavez opened up also 1 year ago, I think it must have been at the end of February last year, he spoke at the social forum in the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, and he said something very interesting. I think it's relevant not only for Venezuela, it's relevant internationally for the anti-war movement, for all those who are fighting against privatization, to defend workers' rights and so on. He said, at the beginning, when I came to power, I was thinking that you could have something like a third way. In fact, he said, I got this idea from Tony Blair. Chavez was here in this country just before being elected president. He had a chat with Tony Blair. Chavez had no previous political experience or background, so he just thought that this was a good idea, third way. After all, socialism has failed, and well, third way. But then in this speech he said, but now I realized I was mistaken, that there is no such thing as capitalism with a human face. This is a farce, and the mask has fallen and shattered into pieces. I'm not making this up, this is what Chavez said. I have my own opinions, but this is what Chavez said. And then he said, within the limits of capitalism, there is no way that the problems of misery, inequality, and poverty of the Venezuelan masses can be solved. We must go beyond capitalism, and this means going towards socialism. But socialism cannot be socialism of the 21st century, where important mistakes were made. Socialism must be socialism of the 21st century, which means it must be based on revolutionary democracy and the participation of the people. Now, this is not the speech of a small group of Marxist activists in a demonstration or in a small meeting. This is the speech of an elected head of state who is at the head of a mass revolutionary movement that is taking place in Venezuela these days. And he has raised this issue of the debate about socialism that was completely off the agenda for 15 years since the fall of the Soviet Union. This in itself is very important because this debate now is everywhere in society. In fact, the last Congress, this is a funny thing, the last Congress of Fede Industrias, which is one of the employers' organizations, they had a debate. They had a debate, socialism of the 21st century and the role of employers. Now, obviously, everybody understands different things of what they want to see as socialism of the 21st century. Within the Bolivarian movement, within the government, everywhere, there is obviously a reformist sector, more moderate sector, conservative sector, bureaucratic sector, that thinks that socialism of the 21st century should mean social democracy reforms, but maintaining capitalism basically as it is. But then there's a more radical section of the movement that want the movement to go ahead, and that for them capitalism means precisely this: socialism, workers' control, participation, revolutionary democracy, control from below, elected officials, and so on. Now this is the main debate that is taking place now in Venezuela, in my opinion. The counter-revolution has been defeated on a number of occasions, and they are now, to a certain extent, weak, divided, demoralized. They don't have the same basis of support that they had 3 years ago amongst the middle class, for instance. Last demonstration of the opposition gathered about 1,000 to 2,000 people. In January 2003, they could mobilize 200,000 people in Caracas. These people are now no longer following the leaders of the opposition. So they cannot launch right now, immediately, an all-out assault, another coup against Chavez. Also, the elements within the army have been largely forced. They came out in a military coup. They declared themselves in disobedience, so they are now outside of the army. Most of the more reactionary army officers. So what they're trying to do, as in many other revolutions throughout history, is to use the moderate wing within the Bolivarian movement in order to stop the revolution and prevent it from going any further and actually defeating them on a serious way. And there's many debates around this. For instance, there's a debate about the state, because the state is basically the same state that existed before. And many people say you can put a revolutionary as a minister, but if all the structure of the ministry remains the same, his initiatives will be sabotaged. This is one debate that is taking place now. And then there is another debate that the owners of industry, the banks, and the land, they largely still have the economic power intact. And they are using this to sabotage the revolution. Earlier this year, there was an attempt to sabotage the distribution of food, including coffee, beans, and so on, that form part of the basic staple diet in Venezuela. And so there are sections of the Bolivarian movement that say, well, we must take over the whole of the economy and run it under the control of the communities, the people, and the workers who work there. This is the only solution. That is, it's a genuine socialism. You can't have socialism and still have two Spanish multinational banks controlling 90% of the banking sector, banking and finance sector in Venezuela. So, just to finish to say this, the fact that the opposition, the oligarchy, is weak and divided and has been defeated doesn't mean that they are not dangerous. A wounded beast can be even more dangerous than the one that is completely healthy. And there's a lot of talk about the possibility of a political assassination of Chavez, the way of disorganizing the movement. There is also another thing that they are doing, which is that they are trying to use Fulia, which is an oil-rich state in the border with Colombia, trying to promote nationalism or independence for Fulia as a way of breaking up the country, creating a conflict, and grabbing the oil reserves. This is one way. Diplomatic pressure, all sorts of mechanisms. So the Hands of Venezuela campaign, which was set up in December 2002, is still very much relevant. And regardless of the different opinions that one can have about the actual revolutionary process in Venezuela, we all have a duty to defend this revolution. Because if Venezuela is defeated, this will be a big blow, not only for Venezuela, where many people will be killed and physically eliminated. It will be a big blow for Cuba, a big blow for the revolutionary process that is taking place in other parts of Latin America, and a big blow also for us here that are fighting against privatization, we're fighting for decent health care, that are fighting for many of the conquests that were gained in the past, and we're fighting against war, imperialist war in Iraq, and so on. It will be also set back for us. This is why Venezuelan revolution is not only important for Venezuela, it's not only something that's happening in a faraway country, something that affects all of us, and the debates that are taking place there should also be taking place here. We can learn from the Venezuelan revolution quite a lot, but first of all, we must defend the Venezuelan revolution. That's why we appeal to all of you to, in any way you can, participate in the Hands of Venezuela campaign, set up local groups, organize screenings of the marvelous documentaries that exist about the revolution, and generally get involved in the Hands of Venezuela.